Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, broadcasting today from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association Energy Fair. This is a really wonderful fair. I've had a chance to walk around. Jim Packard and I were looking at the solar collectors, and my goodness, I'll tell you what, there is a, what is that, Jim, a solar oven out there? A solar oven out there that'll bake 50 loaves of bread at a time. Jim said I could put that on top of my car and drive to work, and on the way, there you got 50 loaves of bread. I tell you, there are lots of great things to see here. Not only that, but there are 270 exhibitors. There's over 200 workshops. We sat in on a workshop just prior to this show on seed saving, and there, I tell you what, the broadest variety of events and things connected with energy that you're ever going to see anywhere. There's a clean energy car show. There's a green home pavilion. There's a sustainable table workshop area. There's a farmer's market. And you could spend a week here. Unfortunately, you only have 3 days. It goes through Sunday. So I hope you can make it to Custer, Wisconsin, just outside of Stevens Point. There's lots going on. If you want to find out information about it, just go to the Midwest Renewable Energy Association website. You'll find out there's still plenty of time to get here. And you're really going to enjoy what you'll see here at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association Fair, including things about gardening. And what better topic on a Friday than gardening with our two guests, Melinda Myers. Hi, Melinda.
Good morning, Larry.
Melinda is, of course, one of our regulars. She is the host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. She's taught horticulture classes at Milwaukee Area Technical College. She's the author of many gardening books, including Can't Miss Small Space Gardening, Month-by-Month Gardening in Wisconsin, and many more, too numerous to mention. And she does a wonderful job answering your questions. And Ken Schrader with us as well for the first time, isn't it, Ken?
That's correct. Good morning, Larry.
Ken's from Stevens Point, Portage County, UW Extension Ag Agent, knows a lot about plants, obviously, as well. So the two of them are going to tag team it with us today and answering your questions. Certainly, if you'd like to join in, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And we have a big audience. If you don't believe me, I'll have them clap. Clap a little bit. What did I tell you? We got a big audience today, and they'll be raising their hands too and asking questions as we move along today. And we're going to have a lot of fun. And again, certainly join us 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Melinda Myers.
Yes.
Welcome.
It's great to be here. I have to tell you a funny story. I started my career in the late 70s. I was very young at the time, of course.
Were.
And worked with the Young Adult Conservation Corps, and energy conservation was really big back then. Mm-hmm. And we made solar hot dog cookers back then. So I did try putting them on my car, Jim. It didn't work very well, but I'm sure technology's improved greatly since then.
All right. Well, Ken Schrader, you've probably been a pretty busy guy. The weather in Portage County has been like the weather in many other parts of Wisconsin.
Right. We've been seeing a lot of rain in the recent 2 weeks. Fortunately, here in Portage County, we didn't get the deluge that they had down south. And the other fortunate thing is we are on fairly sandy soil, so we can take that moisture. As a matter of fact, give us a couple days, and right now things are getting dry already. So a little bit different perspective, but again, calls coming in, questions on how to deal with the cloudy, rainy weather and the aftermath. So.
And the aftermath, and a little more water in your part of the woods there, Melinda.
Oh, you bet. I mean, gardeners, it's everything from, we've seen the terrible news on the pictures on the news and gardeners being upset as well. I think once you finish cleaning the water out of the basement and the landscape, the flooding has subsided. A lot of gardeners are wondering what to do. And some gardeners still have their landscapes underwater. So a couple things that I always say, assess the damage. As soon as you can get out there, see what's going on. We really worry about big trees, the trees that maybe have fallen over because the soil was saturated and they couldn't stand stand up or winds or broken branches, call a certified arborist. They've been trained. They voluntarily get certified. They're the people with the skill and the equipment and knowledge to do the job safely and take care of those hazards. And then if you have a garden that was early and just the lettuce and the spinach and the beets and radishes ready to harvest, if it was under floodwaters, wash it off well. If it was under exposed to raw sewage, get rid of it. Yeah, it's not worth taking a chance. I know we wait, but there's still plenty of time to plant. You just have to count the number of days till the first frost in your area, or guess. We all know how that works, right? And then look on the back of the tag, look on the seed pack, and it'll tell you how many days from planting to harvest. And if your garden needs a lot of work, pots are always a good solution, container gardens as well.
Well, you know, there's the salmonella scare for tomatoes is still out there, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And one of the last reports, and you may be able to answer this better than I, was that they're also concerned that it's not just washing it off the surface, but within the skin of the tomatoes. And that's another concern they have.
Yeah. Well, and the challenge with that is if you get little folds or grooves or cracks in the tomatoes, it's easily retained in there. It's a lot more difficult to wash that off.
Well, one way to avoid it is to plant your own, and we're getting a little late.
Well, I'm going to confess. I just put my tomatoes in this past week because I have to tell you all what to do, so I always run out of time. But I use, believe it or not, tomato boosters, those red plastic things that go around the tomatoes that I thought were a gimmick, but I tried them. Sped up harvest by a month. If we ever get, we've got cooler temperatures in some parts of the state. We've been pretty cool yet. Yeah. And so I use a season extending fabric, a floating row cover, traps the heat. So it gives it a little bit of a nudge. And then once it's staying warm, its plants start blooming. It's a good chance. And you can cheat because a lot of the garden centers have some pretty good sized tomatoes in pots that are blooming already. So if you want to cheat a little bit, you can take a little help from them.
We have some questions. By the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's take a question from the audience.
Yes. I'm wondering about garlic.
Mm-hmm.
To pop the heads off or not to pop the heads off. And I've been reading the book Growing Great Garlic, and he tells you everything. And I'm from, like, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on popping the heads off.
All right. Who wants to take that one?
I would pop the heads off because the energy is going to go to those flowers. Garlic's a tricky one in our area. Our seasons aren't, you know, they really get a best start if you do a fall planting. They get through the winter, and then they can grow, and then they set that bulb. You know, once they start setting the flowers, you're putting a lot of energy into the seeds. And it may not help you get a better garlic harvest, but it's going to at least help redirect that energy to the base. It's a tough crop to grow here.
All right.
And she's not done.
Do you recommend popping them off as soon as you see them, or should they harden off a little bit?
The seed heads, I would take them off right away because as long as they're on there, they're absorbing energy. That's an energy sink. Flowers and fruit, energy sink.
Makes sense. Well, let's take another question from the audience.
Hello, Melinda and Ken. I'm Judith from Waukesha.
Hi, Judith.
And
hello.
I have an existential question.
Uh-oh.
I don't know if I should go to a priest or to a gardener. I have a huge black walnut tree and also maple trees, and every year when I garden, the little black walnuts come in where the squirrels have dug them into the ground, and the maples come up, and I go through a season of potting them and giving them to friends, and then I go through a season where I've kind of given up and I start pulling them up, and last night I pulled up the most beautiful little black walnut tree that still had the nut around the stem, and it's lying out there dying, so I wonder...
The forgiveness you'll need the priest for, okay?
There you go.
You mean I can't get gardener's absolution?
For me, that I can handle. Ken, you want to go there?
Sure, no. Well, to me, depending on if it's in your garden, it's a weed, so you tend to want to get rid of it. If you have an area or friends that are willing to take black walnuts that have a more natural area where they're not affected by your vegetable garden, they're great trees, you know. Trees are trees, and if they grow well, I would maintain them. But again, when it comes to having them next to your garden, there are lots of problems with those plant hormones that are washed off the leaves and the nuts, and we have issues growing many of our vegetables in that area. So I can't argue with you for pulling them out because they're a pest in your garden area.
The other thing, if it's a maple that seeds heavily, it's probably a Norway maple, and they're really considered invasive in much. I'm not trying to make you feel bad now, but they're considered invasive in much of the state. So really, you're helping nature by pulling them and composting them. Recycling, it's a good thing.
All right. Well, we have some more questions. Let's take another question. Jim Packard, we'll get you right up here to the front. There we go.
I have three rain barrels. One question, has there a study been done on when it's running off the roof, the tar or anything going leaching into the water? Just curious.
That's a good question.
One of the things I've heard is, and it's been a while, and so that's a good question probably for someone out there, but the last research I had seen, and it's been a while ago, was really the safest thing is to use it on non-food crops. So run those into your vegetables and things just to be safe. I'm sure there's a resource out there we can double check as well. Meaning we'll go after the show and look. But I would just stick with, if you're concerned, I'd stick with vegetables. Plus, you don't know about all the particulate, and depending on where you live, I'm in the city, so there's a lot of stuff in the air coming down. So I play it safe and use mine on my flowers and such.
One of the things with the rain barrels, too, now this particularly this year with all the rain we've had in so many parts of Wisconsin, we had Phil Pelletieri on the other day. And if depending on how your rain barrel is set up, it could become a perfect area for mosquitoes to breed. So you have to, set it up so you can't, the mosquitoes can't get in.
That's right. You need to have those the top screened, and also that way we're hopefully keeping the mosquitoes out. Have it in a shaded area so we're not having to deal with the algae growth in the container as well. So location is important to think about.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we have some more questions from the audience. So let's go right up to Jim Packard running all over the place here.
When you're talking about rainwater, I'm actually working on restoring a shoreline and building rain gardens so that when the water comes off, it'll drain into to stop the fertilizer from going into the lake. Any suggestions on, rain gardens? Where's the best resource
There's
for
some
the
good
plants,
resources
for the
out
information,
there.
You know, that type of thing?
I have to tell you, I've been lucky enough to travel around the country speaking to gardeners, and I was on the West Coast. I was in Seattle, and I talked about rain gardens. And they use our resources from Wisconsin, which I think Ken is going to hold up right now. UW Extension, Department of Natural Resources, very good resources. Michigan has done a lot of work in Minnesota as well. So if you visit their university websites, that's another option. Rain gardens, not only great idea to keep all the product out of the lake, but, you know, your concern about roof water, that's a great way to recycle it from the roof down your rain chain into your rain garden, at least 10 feet from your house, because none of us need more water in our basements. And there's work that needs to be done. It's prepping a garden, okay, and placement's important. Mm-hmm. But Ken's right. These are the best resources that I've found as I've traveled the country.
And they do give a very good example of a nice rain garden. The problem that I'm having is locally, which I always prefer to buy local rather than the internet, nobody handles native, when I say native plants, you know, I haven't been able to find a local florist or place that actually handles them. I can order them online. I found a good facility for that. But that's kind of what I'm asking.
One option, again, checking online and locally, we have Prairie Nursery who produces some native prairie plants. That the native woody plants can be a little bit more of a challenge to find, but they're out there.
And I think they're Johnson's Nursery in my neck of the woods. But you know, if you're a gardener, you'll drive anywhere to get plants, right? But I think one of the things is, besides looking on the internet, if you have a nature center in your area, a lot of times they'll do special plant sales. Check with your master gardeners through the UW Extension Service. They often do plant sales and may have some of those harder to find. Ask, go to your garden centers. It's a whole catch-22. They have to grow things they know they're going to sell to make money so they can stay in business. And if you and other friends say, look, put these in, we'll grow, you know, we'll buy X number of flats. They'll start growing things for you. And I've done that. I've had gardeners do that with, you know, if you're a regular someplace, they'll usually pop a few flats. And if they, you know, I'm coming back honest, you know, I come every year, I'll bring some friends, we'll buy these, and they may throw a few extra flats together and sell them and then start driving that business. So mm-hmm. you can, it's not easy, but you can be that person creating that change.
Very good question. We're broadcasting today from the Energy Fair from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Melinda Myers and Ken Schrader. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Larry Mueller with Jim Packard on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You may be having some problems. Keep trying that number, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. We'll get you on. In the meantime, we have a very inquisitive audience here at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, which is a really good thing, and we have another question. Your name is?
Carolyn, and I live in the Twin Cities, and I take care of the lawn at this condo building I live at, and we had 3 ant piles. Never seen them before over the years. Do you know what causes it, first of all, and secondly, what to do about it?
Are they large? Well, how large are they?
Probably one of them's about 2 feet in diameter, another one's about 1 foot in diameter, that range. And they're annoying.
You know, I caught the end of Phil the other day talking ants, and I, you know what, my whole front pavers are just loaded with ants, and you know how much rain we've had, and I'm thinking, you guys should be drowned by now, and they're going nuts. They like well-drained soils. You find them, you know, that's why we often find them in our patios and pavers. They like, you know, the sandy soils
here. Sandy soils, we find them,
they
yeah.
do great. I'm not sure why. I think when the conditions are right, if there's a food source for them, they will be there. We've had bad ant populations the last few years, and I don't know, Phil, I caught the end of the show and I couldn't mm-hmm. call in. One is I kind of choose to live with them to some extent. If it was 3 feet by 3 feet and disrupting the roots of my plants, we might be talking doing something. Borax, they've done research and found borax is good at killing ants. Now, boron is a micronutrient used by plants. So a little bit is good, a little more can be deadly, and a little less could be deficient. So I always am nervous about recommending borax in a planting bed. But some of the new ant killers do use borax as an active ingredient, or the other product are permethrins, which are a synthetic version of a plant-derived insecticide, per, P-E-R, methrin, M-E-T-H-R-I-N. And what's cool about this one, if there is, you know, it's a pesticide, but it's a small amount of active ingredient. So they've been able to kind of isolate it. So if you apply it right, you're using less product. You know, obviously you try not to use anything, but
the trick is to get the product down deep. So what you need to do is have a rod or something and make 4 or 5 holes around the in the ant hill itself.
Larry, you've been reading.
well, I listen to my own show.
You're up to date on your...
I'm going to let Ken finish this.
No, you're heading down the right track. Yeah, the challenge is to get that down where the queen is. Because if you can eliminate the queen, you're in good shape. If you can't eliminate her, then the population will go on. So it is, you know, whatever you're using... Just a surface application isn't going to do it, so you really need to get it to go down in there using enough liquid. And the option is to insert a few, you know, holes down deeper so that you get that percolation.
6 inches approximately, or
lower about 6 inches, or
you can go down deeper than that. That
if you can.
That queen is below the surface. It could be 2 feet or so.
Okay, so just get a metal rod that's maybe a quarter inch wide or so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And is there a more organic way to deal with this? I don't know how toxic borax is to our rivers and ponds, or
I don't know. I think that's why I usually say I live with mine. I live in the city, and there's so much pavement, but you know they're in my their walkway, so it's a little easier to live with than in the middle of my garden. I don't know of anything else that, other than using, you know, the products as labeled and always read and follow label directions, even if it's a natural product. I just always like to put that warning out, just because you can get it under your sink doesn't make it necessarily safer than the pesticides on the shelf.
That's right. You always have to be careful of that. I've heard of the using boiling water But, of course, the soil is going to cool that down. I mean, if you have direct rods down in there, I don't know how effective that is, really.
All right. Well, good questions. Thank you for that. And we'll take some more questions here. Another question from the audience while we're setting up our phone system here.
Hi, I'm Peg, and I'm from the De Pere, Wisconsin area. And I've recently got rid of one of my flower beds because it was had the crown vetch. I've struggled with it so much, and so finally we plowed it, you know, took the whole thing out. But I'm wondering now, will it still come up in the area that it was at, and how do I get rid of it?
Ken, no, that's not fair. He just sat back from the microphone.
He leaned away.
That's a challenge.
And I'm sorry for those of you I'm hackling into the mic. The Department of Natural Resources has a great spot on their invasive plant area that talks about crown vetch. It's, you know, when I used to teach at the technical college, my students, we go to ground covers and I talk about crown vetch, why you don't want to put it in. And a couple of students said, you know, they still sell that stuff. I'm like, I know. And it takes years to get rid of. And mowing, you know, strategically mowing spring and fall, you know, mowing can eventually take care of it, but you've got all that seed in the soil, so it's going to take a long time. Solar rising might help to some extent. Covering your garden, you know, 6 to 8 weeks in the heat of the summer, Kansas State University, you're out. Old home state, alma mater, found that 6 to 8 weeks full sun, you could solarize and do some control of weed seeds in the ground.
Yeah, and for the plant itself, I mean, Roundup works good, but of course that kills everything in the area. Keep that in mind. But if you have a massive area, Roundup is very effective because it gets taken up by the plant and located down into the root system, killing the roots and the whole plant rather than just burning back the top. And from an environmental standpoint, that is reasonably environmentally friendly because there is no soil activity connected with using Roundup. So if you have a massive area, I'd look at using Roundup because we're dealing with something similar to quack grass, if you're familiar with that. You know, it spreads and likes to keep on growing. So.
Okay. Thanks very much for that question. Jim will be getting another question. What about insects this time of the year? What are we getting? What are you guys hearing out there from folks?
I'm starting to see some aphids, and, you know, despite all the rain, you know, we've had a few dry days, and it just seems like they're all coming out full force. Some sawflies, of course. You know, we got through caterpillar season. I'm waiting for the Japanese beetles to be emerging soon. The population's really growing in our neck of the woods, and last year I was finding adults clear through August, and usually they're not out that late, so hopefully they laid their eggs too late and they died, but I doubt that that's the case. So I just think there's a longer period. So I'm kind of seeing some of the common things. We've had enough rain. It's keeping things down.
We're
just starting to see things in my neck of the woods.
Ken, how about you?
With the cooler weather, the same thing. We're starting to see Colorado potato beetle show up a little bit. Gypsy moth is well on its way to doing its thing for the summer, but there's not a whole lot we can do about that, I guess. Let let it take its course. Hopefully it'll run its 10-year high and the population's going to crash. I did hear Phil Pelletieri was commenting that with the cooler, wet spring, he seems to be challenging this insect a little bit more. It really doesn't like that cloudy, cool weather, so hopefully that will help.
Knock it down for this year, anyway.
Yes.
Well, we have another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Brenda from Des Moines, and I've got some property just south of Des Moines, and every year I see more and more poison ivy on this property. Mm. How do I get rid of it, and how do I keep it gone?
Boy.
And it's a large area.
Large area. I had a friend who had some poison ivy on a pretty large area, and she didn't know it was poison ivy, so she went out and hand-pulled it.
She didn't burn it, too, did she? Just to make matters worse.
She suffered for a long, long time afterwards. But anyway, go ahead.
Roundup, brush be gone.
And then read and follow label directions, you know, because Roundup, as Ken mentioned earlier, is a total vegetation killer. Brush be gone's a little stronger, so especially for more mature plants. And then just leave it, if you can, decompose in place as opposed to pulling it out because those oils are still active. Do not burn because the oils will go in the air, so you don't want to do that. I don't know that you could ever get rid of it. Seeds will be in the ground. Birds will be bringing the seeds in. It's obviously a good place for poison ivy to grow. So it's one of those you're probably going to have to just kind of keep an eye on. If you end up planting in that area and mulching, using mulch on the soil, it won't eliminate it, but it will help slow it down. I think the more you're in there, I always wear gloves and long sleeves and things like that to protect yourself.
Right, and check the surrounding areas to your property. There may be property that has it growing like crazy, vines growing up on the trees, and so if there's somebody you can talk to about eliminating that would be very helpful. We had to deal with a fair amount of it while I was in Kansas, and it's just ongoing in your backyard. You'll see seedlings popping up here and there, so just keep your eye out for it and have the little Roundup bottle ready and squirt them and knock them down as soon as you see them, but it's a challenge to keep it.
And we have, I believe, a caller online, Paul in New Berlin.
Thank
Paul,
you, Larry.
Are you there?
Yeah, sure.
Hi,
am.
Hi, Paul.
And I'm about to head up to the fair, but I had a question regarding sustainable energies integrated into a comprehensive approach to gardening offline. And where do they have information regarding, let's say, either for gardening on hillsides where you could use gravity collections of gravity feed systems, gathering the water for rain barrels, and then having a time release space with moisture sensors so they could have a distribution of a drip system, or alternative maybe bicycle pumps to pump up water to fill those barrels for a gravity feed system, or integration of photovoltaic energies for composters that would possibly even harvest some gases as far as accelerating the process of creating compost for the garden. Are there integrated systems on display or just ideas up there?
Okay, I was lost trying to find the tent. I didn't go by that exhibit, but I would think this would be the place to find out. I just have to mention, you're talking about the bicycle pump. Have you been to the Urban Ecology Center? They use a bike pump in their cistern to pump water out into the garden. And apparently this technology, and it's just a bicycle pump-driven pump, is used in Africa and in the Middle East and drought-stricken poor areas to get water where it's needed. I don't know, Ken, if you've seen anything in terms of good displays in this area.
Well, again, I haven't been out touring the grounds yet either, but I know that Sustained Dane has a tent here, and they're promoting rain barrels and other sustainable, I think, rain gardens and so forth. So look for them as one source, as we talked about rain barrels before. So.
There are several workshops on sustainable living, and I would certainly advise you to take a look at those. There are a lot of workshops that will be dealing with that sort of thing throughout the course of the fair. So thanks a lot, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it very much. We have Marv from Spring Green online, so let's go to Marv.
Hello.
Hi, Marv. Thanks for calling.
My pleasure.
What can we do for you?
I have an organic vegetable garden, and for many years I've thrown fruit and vegetable garbage onto it to decompose, compost out. And we also spent flowers, parts of plants on it. And it occurred to me one day that there are probably some toxic house plants, ornamental things that we grow around the house. Can you help me on that?
Well, I don't know.
Are you worried about it poisoning you? Is that what you're concerned about? Is that if the plant is toxic, if you would eat it and then you compost it?
Well, no, you compost it first, and would any of the toxins go into what I'm growing?
I wouldn't, no. Most of those things are in the plant.
If you're doing a good job of composting, and in particular if you're using a warm compost method where you get that compost pile heated up, we get good breakdown of most of those plant products, so I wouldn't think you'd need to worry about it. The thing you want to keep in mind, you talked about putting a lot of things in this compost, keep the diseased plant material out of there because the chances of that breaking down, unless you're really bringing that temperature up there, some of our disease plant material, you will then carry that on into your next crop. So keep the disease plant material out.
And yeah. I think kind of keeping in mind that plants pull up nutrients, so a lot of the toxic substances in plants are not the basic elements that plants are pulling up. So even if you've got that plant in there, it's going to break down eventually, and before the plants are pulling things up, they're in their more elemental form, and it's a lot of things like the salicylic acid or Diefenbach. You have those little crystals that can make you go, you know, my cats eat them, and they still whine loudly. But don't feed them to your cats. But, you know, it's something to be concerned about eating directly, but not when you're composting it in your garden.
Right. Thanks for calling. Let's take a question from the audience here.
Hi, I'm Cindy from Westby, Wisconsin. And my question has to do with the intertwined roots of different plants. I have a dogwood, a native dogwood, that just came up in the roots of a I think it is a dead pine, and I also have a maple tree that is coming up within a snowball bush, and it's gotten awfully tall because I could never decide which one to kill. So now it's really, the problem is even bigger, but I particularly want to know how to make sure that that dogwood tree takes off and does well, and also how to decide between the snowball bush and the maple and how to kill them.
Well, that's got to be a personal choice kind of thing, I think. But well, Ken, what about it?
Yeah, I think you're right. I can't help you decide between that, the snowball bush and the maple, was it? Yeah.
When I do decide, how do I kill the one I don't want?
Well, just keep cutting it back.
Would I affect the plant that's growing right in it? They're growing in each other.
Right. No. If you're going to take the maple out, I'd take it down sooner rather than later. As far as the snowball bush, if you want to kill that, I'd pull it out and just keep any, or cut it off. You know, if you keep cutting it off, it'll want to resprout, but eventually it'll give up the ghost.
Yeah.
Okay, and the dogwood?
And you said the pine tree was dead, right?
I think it's dead, but I also think there's sprouts of a box elder coming up. It's a real fertile spot, I guess.
Take the box elders out. Pull them out.
Yeah. Pull them out.
That's a weed tree. You don't want that unless you have nothing else that's going to grow in the area.
Don't use Roundup?
It's not necessary, you know.
If you do decide, I would cut it back, let it resprout, and then paint it on the leaves if you're taking out the maple. But if you just keep cutting it, you'll achieve the same thing. And you may want to do that anyway because it sounds like you do have a fertile spot. So you may want to do that just to watch what else is coming up in that area. I think one of the big dilemmas gardeners have is we never want to kill anything, and it was a free plant. So, hey, you can't give up a free plant, right? But you're finding the dilemma. And make sure if you decide in favor of the maple, there's enough room for it when it reaches maturity. And that may help you make your decision, too, because those maples are going to get a lot bigger than your snowball bush. So
30 feet tall already.
Oh, my God.
30 feet?
Okay. You're a gardener after my own heart.
Oh.
I would definitely, if you're going to get rid of it, what Ken said, cut it down. And then if it keeps going, either keep pruning it and starve it to death because the leaves won't be there to do it, or carefully, if you put the Roundup on carefully, it's absorbed, but it'll take several treatments anyway.
Right. Okay.
Would it kill the snowball bush?
No, as long as you don't get it on the leaves.
Right.
Because it's taken through the leaves, down the stem, and into the roots. And typically, unlike species, don't graft, do root grafting. Is that because I think that was what you're really concerned about, right?
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Not going to happen unless it's the same plant species.
Thanks for that question. Let's take Yvonne in Brown Deer has a call for us.
Good morning, Melinda.
Hey, Yvonne, how are you?
Well, I'm growing my grandchildren. How about you?
You know what kids do? Yvonne and I work together at Extension, and the last I talked to her, I was expecting a granddaughter. My granddaughter's a year old now, and I'm embarrassed to say, so I need to catch up on my correspondence a bit.
What can we do for you, Yvonne?
Leafland and Mequon carry some native plants. Steins carries a line of seeds that are produced, Prairie's Nursery, I think it is, it's called. And they have a wonderful selection of seeds. Got another question?
Okay.
Mosquito problems. It seems to me, I remember the Bacillus thuringiensis collection, that there was one called BT Israeli that was designed for mosquitoes. And I thought maybe people with ponds or wet areas might be able to use that, if I'm correct on that.
Yeah, they sell mosquito donuts or dunks, mm-hmm. and that's what it is. It's a BT, and you can just pop it in. It's a bacteria that kills, that strain kills only the larva of mosquitoes and fungus gnats. So it's a very targeted, natural occurring bacteria. So thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much for that question and comment. Appreciate it. And let's try Ann in West Allis. Ann, hello.
I've been growing cauliflower and broccoli and other cold products for years. And we always used to use a diazinon wash when we in the planting hole, and we never had any problems with cutworms or maggots or anything. Well, diazinon isn't available anymore. And this year, our cauliflower just really collapsed. So we pulled out one, and there were little white, I think they were maggots all over the roots. So what can we use instead of diazinon, as a diazinon wash, you know, that was in a planting hole?
I check the label, I usually just kind of take my chances, and I rotate my crops, and I do a lot of compost. There's a lot of good microorganisms when you're adding organic matter to the soil. So starting there, which is probably not what you want to hear, but I'm going to tell everybody that really building your soil is a great way to do it. Permethrin has kind of stepped into the place of diazinon. Probably those that know diazinon will feel it doesn't work as effectively. However, it's a safer option when you're looking at pesticides. And most of the vegetable insecticides contain that. That's probably one of the more common ones. A little, not as tough on bees as, say, 7 is, because that's really tough on our bees that we're worried about. Check the label. Look for application rates and also methods so that you can make sure that it is labeled, the formulation you pick up is labeled for use on vegetables and in the soil to fight off maggots. One thing I've had good luck with is I use that floating row cover my plants, and it keeps a lot of the maggots off. It keeps the cabbage worms and loopers off, too, because they can't lay their eggs. And so that's a very good way. And I'd plant radishes in between. And the best crop of radishes I ever got, with no maggot problems, kind of, you know, take advantage of every square inch. And I found floating row covers was a great environmentally friendly way to manage several different pests.
Another good resource is your extension office. Keep them in mind all the time, because they actually have a garden facts sheet on home vegetable insecticides. So it's got the whole list of how to deal with asparagus, aphids, on through cutworms, etc. So keep them in mind. Give them a call and see what they've got for you.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We're broadcasting today from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association Energy Fair and having a lot of fun doing it with our two guests, Melinda Myers and Ken Schrader. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests today, Melinda Myers, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener, author of many gardening books, and Ken Schrader of Stevens Point, Portage County Extension Ag Agent. And we're having a lot of fun today here at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association Energy Fair. Lots of things to see, and boy, are there a lot of people here today walking around. It's a beautiful day, and if you can't make it today, I tell you what, tomorrow and Sunday, everything will be going great guns, and there are many, many great exhibits and a lot of learning opportunities for you. So give it a try. Come on up to Custer, Wisconsin for the Energy Fair. And if you have a question for our guests, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's take a question from the audience here.
Hi. I have little black hard-shelled bugs that eat my strawberries just as they start to ripen. Do you know what those are? How can I get rid of it and still safely eat my strawberries myself?
Picnic beetles are probably the problem. They love overripe fruit, and Ken's nodding his head. You want to take it from there?
No, go ahead. You're doing a good job there.
Some people like to do trapping, putting molasses in a can away from your strawberries so that they go after it. Picking regularly, and I know that's easier said than done because you think you've got them all, and then the next day you go out and find a few you missed. But regular picking and harvesting, they usually go after the overripe ones or those that have been damaged. But, yeah, I know. And then they'll keep moving. So regular picking, you may try trapping and putting a trap outside the area, so the idea is that they go towards the molasses and the yeast mix in the can versus the plants. And I don't know if you have any other recommendations as well.
It's always a good idea to keep your strawberry patch mulched well and keep the berries themselves dry.
Yep. Thanks very much for that question. Let's go
extra protein.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, before I forget about it, Melinda, you are going to be participating in the Midwest Master Gardener Conference, Gardening Through the Continuum of Life, and I really wanted to give that a plug as well.
Oh, I'm glad you did, and they're opening it up to the public. So Master Gardeners around the state and surrounding state, it's the Midwest Conference, so they're expecting gardeners from Canada and 12 states around the country. It's July 19th and 20th. It's on my website, but gardening experts from around the area will be coming and speaking and giving tips. I'll be talking about, those of you that saw me kind of crawl up on stage, I have gardener's knees where I'm fighting right now. So I'm sharing tips on how to keep gardening, tips on how to make it easy, whether it's time limitations, physical limitations, or just new ideas, small space, edible landscape, so all kinds of things. And if you haven't met a master gardener, you've missed a great opportunity to get energized, because they are some of the most exciting people that I've been able to work with. And if you aren't a master gardener, have been thinking about it, I'm sure you'll have joined up by the end of the conference too. But I'll be there both days. I'll be signing books at the Purple Cow booth on Friday, and then I'll be speaking on Saturday. And it's a great chance just to meet lots of other wonderful gardeners and learn something along the way.
And that's at the Wyndham Milwaukee Airport Conference Center, if that's correct?
Exactly. So there's still room in the conference. There's still rooms available. So check the Wisconsin Master Gardener website, or if you go to melindamyers.com, my website, we can get you a link through the events page and get you hooked up with them.
Excellent. Well, let's take another question from the audience.
I have, eaten my strawberries and also in my prairie garden. It forms like a foam, and then you have that little green insect. I don't remember the name. Is that harmful to, strawberries or to your prairie plants?
Sounds like spittle bugs to me, huh? Yeah. They don't tend to do a lot of damage.
They just look bad. Yeah. I live in the city, so the first thing you always think of when you think of them are those kids down the block, right? It's not the kids down the block. Anything, water, if you want to do something, you don't have to. Insecticidal soap will help to spray off the foam, do the soap, but they'll eventually, as Ken mentioned, they don't really harm anything. Just look disgusting.
And one more question from the audience.
I'm Carol from Amherst, Wisconsin. And in addition to that question, a step farther, I find that those spittle bugs, I think that's what they are, end up curling the tops of my plants, especially like sedums and stuff.
If you have a high enough population, you may, but you may also have aphids. Aphids are more likely, especially with sedum. Aphids are small teardrop-like insects. They don't put the spit on them, but they suck plant juices and cause that curling. Strong water, insecticidal soap will work. Neem, N as in Nancy, E-E-M as in Mary, which is a plant-derived product that can be formulated one way to kill insects and one to kill diseases.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Fairly effective if you see aphids on plants. Just get the hose and blast them.
Yeah.
Once you blast them off the plants, you're in pretty good shape.
Thanks for that question. Tom in Stoddard is online with a question or comment. Tom, are you there?
Yes. For the lady with the poison ivy problem, and for all people in general, I urge you to get acquainted with the jewel weed. It's a wild impatience plant, the American impatience, and it has a very translucent-looking stem and leaves, and if you look at it and think about the impatience plant, they do look quite similar. And it has a very small little orange flower, which is kind of like a snapdragon kind of flower shape. And they frequent a lot of times along marshy creek bottoms, but they'll live also in other areas. I have a lot around my yard. And I got into a little poison ivy a couple years ago, and I started having this itch, and I knew if I went to bed, with that on, I would not be able to get to sleep. So I went out and I got some and I crushed it up and made a poultice and made a little bandage around it, and it just went away within a few minutes.
I knew it worked for stinging nettles. I didn't know for poison ivy. Thank you.
Oh, that's great. So it's wild impatiens.
Right. Yes. They are a relative. And if you look at the stem, if you've grown impatiens, it does that watery stem just like impatiens have. And you're right. You usually see it along bogs, waterways, things like that. So, hey, it's worth a try. I'll tell you. I'm
Why
lucky
not?
So far.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate that. Let's take a question from the audience.
From Nina. Maple seeds... The trees drop a lot of seeds. Now, do the earthworms pull some of them down into the ground? Because some of them, they're not laying flat, they're in the ground, pointed up.
Do you ever throw them in the air and watch how they twirl down? Somebody tell me they shot through their hosta leaves. They watched those things come down so fast, they made holes in their... Okay, the poison ivy lady also had the helicopters in the hosta leaves, too. So that's partly how they propagate. And so that's what gets them into the ground to get them
would
started.
Would earthworms pull them down?
Probably not until they break down and start decomposing.
Yeah, they'd have to start decomposing first,
They'd have to chew them up, you know.
All right, thanks a lot for that question. And we've got some more from the audience here, but let's go to Larry in Oshkosh, who has a question online here. Larry, hi.
Hi. My question is, when you're putting out the plants that you buy at the nursery, late annual plants, late in the season here, oftentimes the roots are quite compacted. I've taken to slitting the roots and even cutting the big plug right off the bottom. Is there any research out there or anything that says that should be done, shouldn't be done? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that. Ken?
Yeah, that's a good approach to take. I mean, you don't get too carried away. I had the experience where I had a really pot-bound plant, and I tore it up pretty good, which is okay. But the challenge is after that, remember, you've removed a lot of root system, and you're going to have to pay attention to your watering. But it will, once you take care of it early on and get it going, it'll root in a lot better than if you left that glob on there and really basically stay static. So,
okay. Good. Thank you for that question. And another from the audience.
Earlier you mentioned walnut trees. I was kind of wondering, what is the major problem with them? Is it the leaves? Is it the seed? And how far do you really want to get it away from your garden?
All of the above.
And the roots, too.
Yeah, the roots.
Right. This juglone plant hormone, it gets washed off the leaves. It washes off the fruit. It's carried in the roots. It's any part of that plant. So, as far as how far away, you got to keep it so the drip line and the plant material don't fall on your garden, and you're probably okay. But remember, the roots also go beyond the drip line of that tree. They can extend out sometimes, in some cases, again, as far as the distance from the trunk to the drip line. So.
I've seen roots 200 feet away kind of going on with that because the roots go two to five times the height of the tree away from the trunk, and so you can follow almost the root through the garden. Raised beds, but line it maybe with weed barrier so those black walnut roots don't go to that wonderful soil. Containers, as Ken mentioned, the further the better. 50 feet is what they usually say, but you're still taking a chance. And if you cut down the tree... Don't ever cut down your neighbor's. If you cut down your tree, it's going to take 5 to 10 years for all that to decompose. So you won't be getting more, but it won't disappear overnight.
Is there any vegetable or, I guess, with the flowers or whatever, one end that you could put that might be able to propagate close to the walnut tree?
You might want to try some of your leaf crops. What I always recommend, I did a podcast. It's on my website. Purdue University and The Ohio State University have great list of plants that show tolerance and susceptibility, and you might want to check that out.
As does Young's, and also UW Extension has a list of plants that will grow under a black walnut.
Okay. Great. Yeah. I haven't seen their list lately. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for that. And let's see, John in Schofield, you have a quick question.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if you had any ideas about controlling sumac. You know, I don't know if it's put out by rhizomes, but you cut it off and you get two growing. Some kind of a brush killer or something, but I'll listen off the radio.
All right. Thanks for calling. Controlling sumac. What do you think, Ken?
Well, pulling it out, you know, obviously taking out the more roots you can get out, the better off you are. You know, cutting it back, keeping it cut back, because as long as we don't have leaves on that plant, it can't photosynthesize and produce more energy for that plant to grow. As far as herbicides, you know, Brush Be Gone, Roundup is an option as well. So it's a challenge. Again, once you get that plant, it is very aggressive and does like to keep on growing, even after you cut the tops off.
Yeah. Melinda, anything to add to that?
No, persistence. And I had a student that put it in before he learned how assertive this native plant was, and he said his friends were no longer his friends, and they sold their house. They gave up, so some poor sucker got it after they left.
No,
so
they sold the house?
They sold the house. So.
Oh, my goodness.
That may be the extreme solution.
That would seem to be the extreme solution to me. Well, we have lots of solutions for you, so I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll take some questions again as well from the audience. As we visit here from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association's Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin, lots of wonderful things going on. And stay listening. We've got a lot more here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, broadcasting today from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association's Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin, with a great audience here today and lots of people to see those, 270 exhibitors. We've got over 200 workshops going on not only today but tomorrow and Sunday as well, all day Sunday. Lots of great speakers. I know Jim Hightower is going to be here tomorrow to talk. And tell you what, if you have a chance to come out, you really want to see what's going on in wind power, in solar, and a whole lot more, come out and take a look. It's really something. In the meantime, we're talking gardening, and if you have a question, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890 as we visit with Ken Schrader, the Portage County Extension Ag Agent, and Melinda Myers, one of our regulars here on the Ideas Net, who knows a lot about gardening. And tell you what, Laura in Arpin is online, so let's go to Laura. Hi, Laura. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have a large plant growing along the roadside, and just because of its location, I've been thinking about wild parsnip. And everything I've read so far on wild parsnip, you know, it's a scary plant to touch or what have you. But the flower on the plant that I have is white, and everything I've read about the wild parsnip says that it has yellow flowers. So I was wondering, are they always yellow? Might this be wild parsnip, or what else might it be?
Check out Angelica. That's a plant that's often mistaken for parsnip. It's not blooming in my neck of the woods yet, but depending on where you are, and see if that, the joy of the internet for me is you can do a search, an image search, and find a good educational resource and check out the picture to make sure. Angelica is a wonderful native plant, often used in the garden. It's beautiful. There's some red flowering types as well. I don't know if you have any other thoughts, Ken, of what else, but you're right to tread lightly and carefully.
Absolutely.
Right. You don't want to be handling that if that's exactly what it is. No.
And it's I think if I remember correctly, it's sun activated. So a lot of people will do their weeding and control at dusk and at night, always wearing gloves and long sleeve shirts and things, but minimizing, because if the oils get on your skin and they're exposed to sun, that makes the rash even worse. If I'm remembering correctly, looking at Ken. So you want to go carefully, but check out Angelica. It might be Angelica. I have a lot of people mistaken those two for each other.
And thanks very much for calling, Laura. Appreciate it. And let's go to Diane in Lake Mills next. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I joined you when you were talking about getting rid of sumac, and I have nettles, and we purchased a number of acres of land, and it looks like there's nettles everywhere. And I'm just wondering, other than I heard you talking about Roundup for a number of things, are there ways to get rid of nettles that are really, you know, acres and acres worth?
What do you want to do in the area when you're done?
Pardon? Yeah.
What do you want to do with that, those acres and acres when you're done? What? How do you want to manage that land? What do you want to do to it? Do you want to have a flower garden?
It was originally put into CRP, and at some point I'd like to, we may end up, depending on what happens down the road, once that is over, we may end up, you know, having somebody plant it again. But right now I'd be looking to make some horse riding paths and things like that. So, you know, I'd want to be able to get up and down and not worry about, you know, getting contaminated.
I'm going to throw this out, and then, Ken, you feel free to chime in any time. Would it make sense to mow pathways through that? I'm worried when you're talking acres and acres and you're not replanting it with something to crowd out the nettles, you're just going to have a nightmare. But if you create pathways, and I'm not a horse person, so, you know, I don't know how, but wider than getting in and out, on and off, I should say, in and out, on and off the horse. You can tell I'm not a horse person. On and off the horse, you know, that might minimize the exposure. The gentleman that talked about the jewel weed, you know, you might want to find where that is on your property, too, because that often will help with stinging nettle. But and they're great for butterflies. I mean, they're a food source. I know it's not what you want in that property, but unless you're going to replant and bring some other vegetation in, I think the nettles are going to keep coming back. I don't know if you have any other thoughts, Ken.
Right, that's a good point. If you're going to do the pathway thing, keep in mind that when you're cutting that stuff, you get splattered by that the oils and so forth, and you're going to be itching like crazy. It's going to burn. So if that's what you're choosing to do, keep that in mind. And Melinda, you're right. As far as using Roundup and clearing the area out, you're going to have plans to for what you're going to put back in there, whether you're going to be sowing some grasses of some sort. But when we're opening up an area, we don't want to leave that open too long, because the weeds, of course, are the best opportunists, and they're going to show up, and your nettle will likely come back if you've got seeds in the soil.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'd have to replant pretty quickly then.
You would want to plant. You'd want to plan to knock it down. You know, if you're going to treat it with a Roundup and maybe several applications, and then get in there and replant.
I would look at taking it out towards fall.
Yeah.
You know, and then because then if you can go in, if you want to seed grass in there, it's a good time of the year to seed plant grass, and we have less competition with our annual weeds coming in the fall. So. Fall would be the best.
And Prairie Nursery, which is in Westfield, Wisconsin, and their catalog has some great information about establishing a prairie. So if you're going to do a prairie, it talks a lot about weed control and soil preparation before you put the seed down. So that would be a good resource of information, too.
Yeah, you need to do it right before you put seed down. Otherwise, you're probably not going to be happy with the result.
You'll have wasted a lot of time and money.
Right. Yeah, a losing battle there.
And thanks a lot for calling. Marie in Appleton is up next, so let's go to Marie. Hi, Marie.
Hi. This is a story. A farmer told me that a black walnut tree attracts a bolt of lightning in a storm, and plant one at a certain distance from your house and you'll be safer.
Silence. I haven't heard that one.
No, I haven't heard that one.
Nobody.
I don't think there's anything scientific connected with that.
I think a lightning rod would be a better investment.
You know, if it's the tallest tree in the property, that might do it, but otherwise not.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Marie. And Bill in Sleepy Hollow. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Hey, just have a quick question. Wanted to know if you had any methods for killing quack grass in a bluegrass lawn?
Yeah, I started my career in extension, and I got to work with wonderful gardeners, and this is a very common question. And anything that kills the quack grass kills the bluegrass, because quack grass is a perennial. And I had a gentleman come in, and I said, well, if you really wanted to, you could paint each individual blade of the quack grass, being careful not to get it on your bluegrass, thinking, who would do that? And he goes, okay, I think I will. So for 20 years now, I've been driving around trying to find this guy on his hands and knees painting that quack grass, you know, to kill every individual plant. A healthy lawn, you know, keep your grass tall, mow frequently, you know, fertilize properly. All of that's going to make your bluegrass better able to outcompete the weeds. Though this year, I'll tell you, I don't know what your lawn looks like, but the weeds look really good in mine right now.
Yeah.
The heat and the drought of last year, the winter was tough. So I think we just have a lot of overseeding bare areas or replacing some that, you know, if it's quack grass, over 60%, you might want to start that area over. And as you were mentioning earlier, Ken, late August, September time frame, good time to do that.
Yeah. And things are really growing. The lawns are really growing. This was the year that my wife said, we're going to use a push mower. We're not going to use a power mower anymore. And I said, it'll be great exercise for you, dear.
And you, yeah.
And we've been doing it, but it's hard to keep up with the grass this year. It's really growing in those where we've had all that rain.
Well, you know, it's probably going to dry out eventually, and then you won't be pushing that more for a while.
Okay. The optimist, that's great.
Let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, my name's Wenzel from Amherst, Wisconsin here. And I can plant my carrots in lettuce and all that stuff just fine, and seed germinates, you know, first thing in the summer. But then, say I want to do a succession planting, even putting them in now or even up to the, let's say, the 1st of July, and I can't get that darn stuff to germinate. And I don't know if I'm just negligent in watering or if the heat of the soil or what's my problem.
He can be. Go ahead. Yeah. Looks like you're ready.
It is. You know, the heat of the summer, you're touching on some of the important issues there. It's really hot. The soil temperatures are high. And it's always a challenge keeping the appropriate moisture in that soil to keep that plant growing. When these seeds are germinating, they're very tender, and it doesn't take much drying out to basically kill them off. So,
one of the things I've tried that's been kind of fun, because I'm a drought stress tester. Basically, if you live in my yard, you got to be pretty tough. And a gardener once showed me a trick where he'd sprinkle the very fine seeds just at the soil surface and throw a wood lath over top. He'd water them in so they get good seed soil, and then throw a wood lath over top so that they're really close to the surface. Now, some of them need the light to germinate, but usually that he would just kind of flip it up, and he'd had pretty good germination. With lettuce, I've used the floating row covers to kind of keep the birds off and hold it in place. It lets air, light, and water through. And, you know, heat's not an issue in the middle of the summer, but I find sometimes those fine seeds, if you don't keep it moist, they blow away and the birds will get at them. So I've had some good luck, especially with carrots, with the lath. Lettuce likes light a little bit better, so you may or may not have the same success.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Bob in Mindoro, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I just had a comment for the gal who's got the acreage with all of the nettles. And I've got a similar situation, and what I found works really well is to get a sprayer that you can set the delivery rate right off the end of a hose, and I just bought some hose that got me out to where I needed to go, and then I bought Weed Be Gone and put that in there, and that will shrivel up the nettles, and it'll keep the grass healthy, and if you've got some grass growing with it, that should stay healthy, so you shouldn't have to round up and kill everything or mow it. It seemed to work pretty well. That's all I have. Thank you.
And I think the key is that, and good point, that Weed Be Gone will kill any broadleaf plant, and it lasts in the soil longer. So I think one of the reasons Ken and I often talk about using Roundup, even though it kills everything, when it hits the soil, it's done. So depending on what you want to do, you're right. If it's a lawn area or you have some grass growing, that's a good way to knock them down and let the grass grow. But I think Ken's point, too, is very good about bare space. We all know, as gardeners, the first thing that moves in are weeds. But thank you.
Yep, thanks very much for that comment. Dan in Janesville, your turn.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Hi there. What I wanted to know, I actually have some Mugler pines in my front yard, and they're actually being attacked by something that looks like an army worm, and I wanted to know how to control them.
Sounds like pine needle sawfly to me.
Yeah.
And they are, right, they do a good job of chewing on those needles. For the most part, they're going to feed on the older needles and usually we luck out and the new needles don't get fed on, but there is another soft fly that is showing up that will also then eat the new growth.
The new ones.
As far as dealing with them, usually a good soapy solution works quite well, whether you use a 4 or 5% soap and water solution and just spray it on them. That's pretty effective. The other way is basically shaking them off or pulling them off and squashing them or something like that.
It's a great way to get kids into the garden sometimes. They like the bugs better. And a heavy leather-clad glove, just smash them, as you were mentioning. Prune off the one branch. They usually feed in colonies, and they rear their ugly heads when you get near them. They do this little dance, so you know they're sawflies. and so it's usually a branch at a time. So you wouldn't want to prune the whole plant, but if it was one branch, or just smash them or shake them off. It's a good way to burn off some of that excess energy kids have this time of year.
Thanks for calling, Dad. And Mike in Rice Lake. Your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. First of all, I have a American cranberry that's about 6 foot tall, 6 foot wide. Is that too big to transplant, first of all?
Bigger is always more risky. Yeah. But it can. They're pretty tough. I would not do it now. I would wait till if you can. I'm a big spring transplanter for home gardeners. Fall works for many plants, but if you can get them before growth begins in the spring, you know, get your site prepared, and then. I've moved things because I had to move things, and I've had fairly good success, and I've moved things that should have made it and didn't have quite as good success. So I don't know if you have any. And then take the size root ball you can manage. Bigger is better, but not if you're going to drop it and break it into pieces.
Yeah, okay. I kind of take the approach with transplanting where, yeah, middle of summer, it's not a good idea to do that. Obviously, we're dealing with too much heat and moisture stress issues. But other than that, if it moves me, I figure it's got to go. It's time to move it. The big thing is, again, if you're going anywhere beyond that spring window, you need to pay more attention to how you're taking care of that plant post-transplant.
One of the questions regarding it has something attacking it as well. If I look at the leaves, there's these whitish, creamish-colored streaks that seem to follow the leaf veins. And some of the leaves aren't opening up all the way. They're like stunted and curling just on part of the plant. Do you have an idea what that would be?
They do have a lot of problems with aphids, and the exoskeletons almost look like white threads. I don't know if that maybe is what you're seeing. Especially on the newer growth, I typically see that where they're sucking plant juices, creating that kind of wrinkled, crinkled look. I'd try the strong blast of water. Maybe if that doesn't work, insecticidal soap. If it doesn't sound like what I'm describing, you know, it's a good Google aphid exoskeleton. And you should be able to see a picture, and that might help you clue in as well. We're seeing a lot of problems in our neck of the woods with viburnum borer, but that attacks the base of the plant, and that's a whole different thing. So it's hopefully you don't have that, what you wouldn't see on the leaves. But just for people out there that are seeing wilted leaves and the stems pull off easily, check the base for signs of viburnum borer. Regular pruning, you know, it's a tough one. You can do some insecticide spraying when the mock oranges are blooming to try to prevent the damage. But I'd look for aphids.
All right. Thanks very much for that question. And I do want to mention again before we run out of time, we still have time left, but I wanted to mention again the Midwest Master Gardener Conference, Gardening Through the Continuum of Life. I have that from July 16th through the 19th.
It's probably right, and I apologize. Thank you, Larry. I was just really worried about when I was going to be there. What can I say? Actually, I only know where I'm going to be tomorrow is my problem. And it's a great one. There's a lot of extension specialists from UW, and what a good chance to meet all the people you hear on the radio, too.
Yeah, Mike Weisham from the Victory Garden will be there. Ed Lyon of Janesville's Rotary Gardens is going to be there. Gene Rothard of the Chicago Botanical Gardens.
Excellent hort therapy expert. If you haven't been to their enabling garden, beautiful place.
So that's a chance to meet and mingle with gardening and enthusiasts. It's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime chance in a way, right?
It really is, and it's you know, it's in Milwaukee, which isn't far away for, you know, it's not that easy to get to. Airport's convenient. Freeways are convenient. It's a chance to meet some fun gardeners doing some interesting things.
Absolutely. Well, Judy in Round Lake has a question, so let's go to Judy. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. I got a question for Melinda about strawberries. Okay. With the crazy spring we had, it looked like we got some frost damage on like three different patches. The one, everything looks great. They were honey-o, they're a little later. the other two were like looked like they had frost damage. Now, am I right? When the frost damage happens, the little berry doesn't fully expand. The first part of it's all kind of wrinkly.
Up there, shaking his head, eager to answer this one.
Well, as far as frost damage on those flower buds, they're going to usually see blackening or blackening in the centers, and that would show up. And obviously, when that happens, berry development is not going to happen or be weird shaping if you've only taken out part of that bud.
Okay. Thanks very much for that question as well. And I'll tell you what, we're got a few more minutes to go. You can still join in with a quick question at 800-642-1234, or we get a question from the audience, too. If I'll get somebody over here with a question, Jim Packard, so let's get that person involved here as we move along. And your name is?
My name is Kelly, and I'm from Lodi.
Okay.
And this year I'm putting in a new raised veggie garden, and I'm experimenting with lasagna gardening.
Okay.
A friend recommended it, and I'm putting the garden in over what was my lawn previously. And I haven't been able to find real solid information on, like, how many layers, what to put in the layers. I have access to composted llama and goat manure. I have tons of it free, so that's one of the things I'm putting in. Topsoil, I have leaf mulch from Ulbrich.
Oh, that's great stuff.
I've got a big cart of that. So I was wondering if you could give some recommendations as to...
Yeah, and maybe you could just explain what's lasagna gardening, Mel.
Pat, and I forget her last name, I know through Garden Writers, put together a book on lasagna garden. It's layering newspaper and compost and manures, and it's putting all this good stuff in layers like you would lasagna. They break down and create this great soil to garden in. I've read the book. It's been a while, and it's called Lasagna Gardening. So if you Google it or go to your library, you should be able to pick it up. And she explains exactly how many layers of this and this. I don't know if she has a website or not, and I forget Pat's last name. But lasagna gardening's been out there. So if you Google it, I'm sure you're going to get the guidelines. I do a lot of raised beds. Somebody was pointing out that's how I deal with my bad knee. I should be dealing with my bad knees. That's one strategy. And I just usually use the existing soil and just work it year after year. But sometimes bringing in new stuff or doing this real intense way of creating a great base is a good idea. I can't give you her recipe because I don't remember it off the top of my head, and I don't know if you do, but she's got a book, Lasagna Gardening, and it's got all the details in it. And I think the libraries will have it too.
It sounds wonderful.
It really is. You ought to have her on. She's quite the character. She's from out east and just a really nice lady, a really neat lady. And you ought to get her on sometime. I'm sure you would have fun with it. And she's done some neat things with the whole idea of creating this great soil instantly, because so many of us are dealing with lousy soil.
Yeah, and it really does sound like wonderful soil
when it's done, right?
Yeah, when it's done. Thank you very much for that question, and thanks to everybody here at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. I want to spend just a couple of seconds again reminding you this fair has been going on since 1990, and it's gotten bigger and bigger every year. There's 20,000 or so people are going to be attending this year, more than 20,000, I'm sure, and you're going to have a chance to see 270 exhibitors, over 200 workshops. They have mass transit from Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay. My goodness. There's free hourly shuttles from Stevens Point. You'll see a clean air energy show. There's a green home pavilion that's new for this year. The sustainable table workshop area was right where we are located right now. And that's wonderful as well. The farmers market, there's hands-on workshops, food, entertainment, pretty much everything that you could imagine in the way of energy and how we can live more sustainably. So it's a wonderful opportunity, and I hope you make it out. A big thanks to Melinda Myers and to Ken Schrader for being with us today. They did a wonderful job, as always, and we'll look forward to another visit from them. And thank you for listening. We'll be Monday. Frank Armstrong, author of The Informed Investor, will be our guest, and we'll talk about investing with him on Monday. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.